From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Social psychologist Amy Cuddy first introduced us to what you might call power posing in a 2012 TED Talk. The message of her speech strike the power pose of a full, strong presence. Wonder Woman, Usain Bolt, fake it until you become it, your own full, strong self. And boy, did it resonate. It's one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time, with 31 million views and counting. Now, Amy Cuddy is out with a new book, Presence, about how to cope, thrive in high-pressure situations, how to approach challenges with confidence, not dread, leave with satisfaction, not regret. This hour on Point, Amy Cuddy on the power of presence. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you tried it? The power pose thing before a key meeting, a big moment in life. How'd it go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Amy Cuddy. She's a social psychologist and professor at Harvard Business School, studies how nonverbal behavior and snap judgments influence people. Her new book is Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges. Amy Cuddy, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you. It is such a huge honor to be here.
What we all know about you is Wonder Woman. Stand like Wonder Woman for a couple of minutes, or maybe Usain Bolt, before you go into that lion's den, whatever it may be in your life, and you will be better off once you get there. We know there's a lot to it. We want to dig all the way in, but just start with that. Roll it back. That's what had everybody go to your TED Talk to try and figure out the magic. Really? I can put my hands on my hips and throw my shoulders back for a couple of minutes, and I'm a stronger, better, fuller, truer self?
Well, you can be. I mean, you know, I'm a scientist, so I can't say that anything will work for everyone. But on average, what we find is that when people adopt these expansive, dominant displays in private, so before they go into a stressful situation, because they're not trying to intimidate someone, it tells the brain that they are feeling powerful and confident. So you get the same kind of feedback that you get when you smile. When you smile, it makes you feel happy. So when you throw your arms up in the air as if you've just crossed the finish line and won.
Victory, winged victory.
Exactly. It sort of tells your mind that maybe you have won. So you feel more confident and less anxious going into those situations, which allows you to be in them without that sense of threat, without feeling like a tiger is about to pounce on you and grab you by the throat. So that allows you to perform better, to be yourself, and to leave without that feeling of regret, like I didn't say what I wanted to say.
You're a scientist, so that means, I guess, you experimented with this. You ran people through trials to figure out if this was true. How did you come to this?
Yeah, so we've run a number of experiments, and now dozens of other people have run experiments. But in the power posing research in particular, where we're really talking about adopting a single expansive pose like Wonder Woman for a short period of time, like 30 seconds to 2 minutes, we have people come to the lab and they're randomly assigned to either adopt a high power pose or a low power pose. And a low power pose is what animals do when they're frightened and they want to hide. They wrap themselves up and make themselves small. So it's the opposite
sort
of expansion.
Armadillo style.
Exactly. So we have people adopt either high power or low power poses. They don't know what the hypothesis is, and they don't know that there's another condition. They do that just for a short time in a room alone, and then we take some measures like hormones or risk taking or just how powerful and confident do you feel, and we look at whether or not standing in those poses affects those outcome variables. So that's what we've been doing. And as I said, a lot of other people now have been looking at it in different ways.
The thing that summons or engenders or releases, you call it presence. The sort of god of your book is Walt Whitman. I mean, you've got him right up front. You say, we convince by our presence.
That's right.
You quote him saying, I am larger, better than I thought. I did not know I held so much goodness.
Yeah.
What is that magical, mystical, or very real presence that you want to summon? What is that?
I think what happens is that, and we know this from many other studies, not our own, but from other labs, that when people feel powerful, it activates what's called the behavioral approach system. So suddenly, they start to see challenges not as threats, but as opportunities. They feel more optimistic. They feel more confident. They feel more generally positive. They're more likely to approach than to avoid. And it allows them to reveal who they are. I think power is this very loaded word. Mm-hmm. If I ask people in an audience, what's the first word you think of after power? A lot of people will think, what do you think they would say after power?
Well, I read your stuff and it quickly goes to dominance.
Dominance, aggression, the big one is corruption.
Corruption.
Right.
Okay, power corrupts. Absolutely.
Right.
All right.
And first, I'm talking about personal power, which is power over the self, not power over others. But my favorite quote about power is actually from Robert Caro, LBJ's mm-hmm, biographer. Mm-hmm. When someone once asked him, so, you've studied this guy for years, what's the answer? Does power corrupt? He said, power doesn't necessarily corrupt, but power always reveals. And I think that that's what happens. When people feel personally powerful, they are unafraid of showing who they really are. They're in that moment and excited to be there instead of frightened to be there. And that's how they're able to bring their true best selves forward. And again, they may not get the job, right? The concrete outcome might not be what they want, but they can walk away feeling like I did everything I could do. And so that's really what happens when you make people feel powerful. And it's the same thing that happens when you have people open up their body and expand like a dominant animal.
Throw those arms wide and feel it. It's interesting, though, in our time of self-help and Oprah talking about your own best self and all that, people quickly go to this bottom line of winning. Mm-hmm. You've got winning in there, but that's not all it's mm-mm. about. It's about being fully realized, whatever the outcome, I guess.
That's exactly right. And I have to say, one of the, after the TED Talk, I just was flooded with email. And I still get many emails every day, but, tens of thousands of emails. And people were describing to me these situations that were really challenging. And first, the range was enormous. It wasn't all job interviews. Mm-hmm. Some people were, 13-year-old girl in China trying to speak up in class, or an elderly person trying to work up the nerve to be assertive when they go visit their doctor. But the common...
I see a list. A World War II vet who had lost his pride getting it back. Someone with a kid with autism trying to deal with that. A professional opera singer, tough audition.
Exactly.
On and on. Firefighter. Having the courage to go in.
But what people write to me about, it's funny because I think they mean to write and say, hey, I did this thing and I got the job or I got the role. And sometimes they get to that point. But really what they're writing about is how they felt when they left, is feeling like I did everything I could and I can accept the outcome because I know that I brought my best self forward. And if that's not the right fit for this thing, that's okay. I can live with that. It's the feeling of regret that I want people not to have to live with, regret that they did not show them who they are. And we often walk away feeling like, oh, they didn't see who I really am.
In your book, you've got Pam writing to you from Washington State. Her interpretation of presence, this kind of slippery, amorphous, but powerful notion, she reads you, lives, and says presence is removing judgment, walls, and masks so as to create a true and deep connection with people or experiences. I mean, it must be very hard with a book like this, with a theme like this, to keep it out from going straight into the kind of American Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People mold of listen to Amy Cuddy and conquer.
Mm-hmm. That is not the message that I want to be sending. And you're right. In this day and age, more so than ever, it's very hard to control the message, right? So I can put my message out there, but people are going to spin it the way they want to spin it. On the one hand, it reaches a broad audience, and that's great. But yes, I don't want people to be trying to dominate others. I want them to feel that they have control of themselves. And the funny thing is that when they do that, they're better able to connect with others, to liberate others to be present, and even to liberate others to feel personally powerful. So it's really not about winning. It's not about zero sum. The kind of power I'm talking about is not social power. It's personal power, and it's infinite. And we should want everyone in our lives to feel personally powerful because they will be more open, more generous, more creative, and so on.
People talk about self-trust. Someone characterized this as self-trust, which gets close to almost self-realization. But surely there's a difference. And that gets us, when you bring the body into it, I'm almost off in yoga land all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. But there's surely a difference between striking a Wonder Woman pose and yoga and all the rest. Or is there?
Well, it's funny. I was a yoga skeptic when I started writing this book, not because I think it's unhealthy, but because, I used to be a professional ballet dancer, mm-hmm. and I study body language. So everyone would say, I guess you do a lot of yoga. And I don't. I didn't. I'm going to start doing it, I promise. But I sort of reacted against it like a teenager. Then when I started writing the book, I had to look at that literature, and it turns out the research on yoga.
Is there a triumph pose in there that I don't know about?
There are, there's the warrior pose.
Yes.
And all kinds of poses like that. But the research on yoga, first of all, is now very mainstream, very well done, and the benefits are enormous, especially for people who feel powerless. So, combat veterans with post-traumatic stress. That's mm-hmm. a group that is really benefiting from very simple yoga-based interventions. So rather than talking about what happened, they're expanding their body. I mean, here's a group that feels utterly powerless. They've lost their sense of identity. They've lost their sense of power. They feel that their body has betrayed them. So of course they go into a powerless position. And they don't necessarily want to talk about it all the time, but to teach them to open up their bodies and use breathing techniques that calm the fight or flight response, it gives them this huge sort of tool to take themselves out of those dark moments.
That sounds like a whole practice. We know it is. People devote an amazing amount of time and sweat and energy and everything else to yoga. Yours is like 30 seconds of Wonder Woman, and really, you can grab a piece of that with that little power pose?
Again, I would never say it works for everyone. It certainly works for some people, and it's better than nothing. So I think that posture is really where it's at.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me right there, the sound of a traditional warrior dance of New Zealand's native Maori people. New Zealand's rugby team, the All Blacks, perform it before every game, the Haka dance, thought of as a way to intimidate opponents, but maybe it's getting something going in them. My guest this hour is social psychologist Amy Cuddy. She might say it's all about the pose there, striking there. Her talking about her power pose notions of summoning inner strength, your full self, the power of presence. Maybe it's right there in a haka dance. Amy Cuddy's TED Talk in 2012, the second most watched in the world, 31 million views and counting, sort of took the world by storm. Here's a little bit from that back in 2012.
What are nonverbal expressions of power and dominance? Well, this is what they are. So in the animal kingdom, they are about expanding. So you make yourself big, you stretch out, you take up space, you're basically opening up. It's about opening up. And this is true across the animal kingdom. It's not just limited to primates.
After all, we're primates too. Amy Cuddy is with me in the studio. Her new book off of that TED Talk, Expanding and Expanding, is Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges. And you can join us this hour. What do you think? Does her idea sound simple or deep or both? Have you tried it? Do you have your own version? What is it? What pose? How does it work for you? Here we are. People listen very carefully to this kind of thing, and some are all about it. If you've got to think you deserve the promotion to get the promotion, one of our listeners is writing right here. But there's jaundice out there, too, about, going down this road. Here, Dan writes, presence like mindfulness, genuinely important ways of seeing now being turned into corporate productivity tools. Is that the path we're on here, or what's your goal in unleashing this?
Well, that's not my goal. I think that if people apply this work in corporate settings, I don't think it's going to lead to a lot of bad behavior. I think that this is really about empowering employees to do their best work. Whether it's focused ultimately on the bottom line, that's up to whoever's applying it. But I'm much more interested in giving tools to people who lack formal power. So this is so mm-hmm. simple. It's free. It doesn't require resources or technology. Mm-hmm. Anyone can do it. So hearing from people like that. Let me just tell you one quick story. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing I like to hear. A couple weeks ago, I was giving a talk. A man came up to me, probably in his 50s. He grabbed my arm and said, I really need to tell you this story. I want to thank you for giving me my father back. And I said,
that's a gift.
Okay.
How? What?
What happened? And he said, he has Alzheimer's and he has had Alzheimer's for several years. I saw your talk and I thought, wow, you know, his body is so collapsed. He looks so powerless. And here's this guy who was a World War II veteran who was so proud and powerful and clear. So I thought, I'm going to get him to stand in a powerful pose every morning for 5 minutes with me. Mm-hmm. He said, so we face each other for 5 minutes every morning. And for 5 minutes, I get my father back. He said, he's powerful, he's proud, and there's clarity in his eyes. Now, look, I cannot vouch for the science of what's happening there, mm-hmm. but that's the kind of application that I'd like for people to try, and I'd like to see other scientists exploring what is going on there. You know, so that is an utterly powerless feeling person who is using this and getting a moment of pride.
Cringe and power flows away, strike an expansive posture, maybe power, self-awareness flows to you. Irfan in Boston, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Amy Cuddy.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I was calling in today. I'm a physical therapist by trade, and I'm very glad that this returning team at this stage because if you look at our lifestyle, the postures are everything. We are going in the reverse direction. And expansion of your body, holding your head up high, squeezing your chest, and all the warrior poses. I think basic science explanation behind it is a cognitive stimulation with the neuromuscular re-stimulation of the muscle. And I'm very happy to hear this as a physical therapist that there is someone out there who's talking about posture as a mainstream.
So a physical therapist who doesn't doubt it, where do you see us going, Irfan, in the wrong direction, you say? What, this sort of hunched over our smartphones, looking at our,
Typically, what I look in the clinic at this stage is a forward head. Necks are collapsing. We are reducing our lumbar spine curve, which is natural. And our hips are flexed. Our knees are flexed. Basically, at this stage, it needs to be reversed. And if the power pose is the way to give you cognitive stimulation, absolutely. I mean, if you look at that, another power pose is we crunch our fist and we dump it on the table. It gives the mental stimulation, but at the same time, it's activating our neuromuscular junction where the nerve is innervating at the distal muscles.
Our PT listener speaks, and Amy Cuddy, you're nodding along. I mean, we all know this posture that is so widespread now when people are always looking down at their phones, let's say that forward head, as Irfan says, necks collapsed, lumbar all out of whack. There's got to be a good antidote to that.
Definitely. So I call it eye posture. And
eye as in iPhone or eye. Yeah.
Right, people call it text neck mm-hmm. or the eye hunch. Mm-hmm. Irfan, is that the?
Yes.
Thank you so much for calling. I'd love to hear from physiotherapists because you all seem to really get this. And also, you give me so many ideas about what the physiological mechanisms are. I've heard from so many of you. And one physiotherapist in New Zealand wrote to me and said that he's seen the kinds of humps that you see in older women in 16-year-old boys and girls because of the amount of time that they spend over their phones. So we are sitting often in this very contracted position that is likely to lead us to feel powerless. And in fact, the position that we are in often when we're over our phones mimics the position that people hold when they're clinically depressed. Very hunched over, very collapsed, very powerless. So what are we, where are we going with this? How do we teach our kids to sit up straight without taking the iPhones or the smartphones out of their hands? It's very tough.
Tyler in Dover, Delaware. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in. I'm a combat veteran. I heard about the positive power stances through TED Talk, like most people. And then now I work with children as a middle school teacher. And I'm a huge believer in the power poses. And I've tried to implement it a little bit towards students, mainly before, you know, presentations or to speak in front of people. But I wanted to ask, how would you suggest, how young would you introduce this to children? How, you know, at a teacher and at a student level, what kind of language? It's hard to explain the science to them, but how would you kind of propose at what age and how soon and how would you approach it with them?
Amy?
That's another great question and one that I often get. One thing I want to point out is that at least in my generation, we were told to sit up straight to show respect to others. And I think we kind of reacted against that. I want kids to learn to sit up straight to show respect to themselves, which will then make it easier for them to show respect to others. I have to be honest, again, I don't have the data on what to do with kids, so I don't want to give bad advice, but I certainly hear from a lot of teachers who are talking about different ways of implementing it. One thing that I can tell you is that I see a big difference between boys and girls but when they hit middle school. So before they hit middle school, boys and girls are throwing their arms up in the air and doing cartwheels, and you know, they're not afraid to expand their bodies. When they hit middle school, suddenly the girls start to collapse and the boys don't. In a study that we did with 4-year-olds and 6-year-olds, we find that they are learning this, right? So by 6, kids really strongly associate the open poses with boys and the closed poses with girls. So I think one of the questions in here is, how do we expose our kids to images of girls and women carrying themselves with power and pride without them feeling like, oh, I'm no longer going to be feminine if I do that? But the original question about what to do with kids.
How old? How much? And how to introduce it?
I think that introducing them to good posture early in a fun way is certainly the way to go. And without telling them, this is about showing respect to others.
But Tyler's beyond posture. I think he wants to know how to introduce the whole sort of victory pose, arms thrown up, all that. How do you tell kids what they're up to there? How might you? That doesn't make it just look like a half of a jumping jack.
Well, I do think...
Or maybe jumping jacks are fine for that.
They might be. You know, I think movement adds another dimension to it. But I think that... It's a fun message for kids to understand that, you know, not only is your body expressing how you feel, but how you feel is a result of what you're doing with your body. That's a pretty simple message to tell them. Simply, I think, you know, we have kids sitting all day long. I mean, there's all this research now on the benefits of walking and creativity, you know, getting kids to walk around more. I think that it can't just be one thing. I think that this is a general message that we need to be teaching our kids from the beginning, that how you carry your body affects how you carry yourself in your life. You know, in particular with kids, I think it's relevant to the extreme social threat and anxiety they feel with social media right now. So, you know, if I see my son over his phone and I see his body collapse, I know something's happened on social media that made him feel bad. You know, the kids are just, there are challenges all around them. It's not just in the classroom, it's outside the classroom. So I think that this has to be a much broader message about posture and just carrying yourself with a sense of pride.
I'm looking at a big spread of pages here out of your book, Presence, where you have illustrations actually here of different powerful poses and powerless poses. And exactly as you say, when I look at this, the powerful poses, they are by and large stereotypical our culture's male poses. And the powerless poses are, again, by and large, kind of stereotypical or more often female poses. I mean, what you're proposing in these very postures and poses is a kind of cultural revolution here.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, anyone who knows the term manspreading.
Yeah, here it is. I saw you manspreading with Stephen Colbert the other night. He picked straight up on it.
I didn't ask him to do that, but he did.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
This idea where men will sit with their knees wide apart. And now the New York
City. Or maybe
City,
their hands behind their head and their elbows
head.
Wide.
Right.
Feet up on the table.
Thing is, I don't want anyone doing that. You know,
don't? These are powerful.
Not in interactions, not in front of others. If it makes you feel good when you're sitting alone, that's fine. But the thing that's funny about dominant body language is that in interactions, it causes the other person to collapse, to complement your dominant posture with submissive posture. And what's interesting about this is that this is different from other kinds of nonverbal interactions. Typically, we're mirroring each other or mimicking each other. Mm-hmm. But when one person really starts to show dominance, the other person starts to close up. We don't want that. That's not the outcome or the kind of interaction that we want to be having with people. And that's part of why you do this in private. Now, one thing that I have noticed is that a lot of coaches are using it, I mean, sports coaches. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they do have their teams all of the members of the team do power poses together facing each other. Mm-hmm. But that's because they are trying to feel powerful as a unit, mm-hmm. as a collective. So they're not feeling threatened by each other. They're feeling connected to each other, which is similar to the haka that you played a little clip of New Zealand
rugby guys.
Exactly.
Take us back to your own body's trauma, kind of very significant trauma, and how it helped put you on this path of inquiry.
Yeah. So I was, when I was 19, I was a sophomore in college. And
Wyoming, Montana.
Yeah. University of Colorado. Mm-hmm. We had gone up to Missoula, Montana for the weekend. We were driving back overnight. It's like a 15-hour drive. And we were taking turns. And in the middle of the night, my friend who was driving ran off the road just a bit and overcorrected. And the car rolled a few times and I was thrown out of the car. I don't remember the accident, but I woke up in a hospital and had had a traumatic brain injury that caused me to be withdrawn from college. You know, I had already missed a lot of college by the time I became sort of coherent, and I was told that my IQ had dropped by two standard deviations, which is 30 points.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And I then realized that being smart was a bigger part of my identity than I had ever thought it was, and also that I never feared losing that. You don't fear that something will happen that will make you not smart. You fear that something might happen that will prevent you from walking or moving, or you'll lose your hearing or your vision. And and so this was just a total, turn upside down of my identity.
You had to kind of refine it or rebuild yourself.
I did. I mean, the thing about this kind of head injury, and I'm so glad that there's more attention to this now, because I think we're just starting to understand these closed head injuries. What happens is that if you think of the brain as an onion with different layers, mm-hmm. and each layer is a different density, when you suddenly stop, those layers are moving at different frequencies against each other. And so all of these axons that connect those different layers are being torn. So you have an injury all over the brain. They call it a diffuse axonal injury. Mm-hmm. What that means is that you're not going to have a change to just one function like movement or speech. You're going to be different in almost every way, your thoughts, feelings, your behaviors. And it's very hard to remember what you were like before that. So you're not just dealing with getting your cognitive capacities back in order. You're also dealing with people telling you you're really different now.
Talk about presence. I mean, that's kind of the essence of it. You have to rediscovering, recreating your own presence.
And what I really found was that for me, one of the things I had to do was let go of trying to find my former self. I sort of had to break up with my former self and have the faith that there was a new self out there, sort of like leaving a not so great relationship, hoping there's somebody better out there for you. So I was hoping there was another self that I would find and eventually, but I had to let go of that old self.
Your brain as it was, as it had been traumatically reconstructed.
But of course, you know, I was just really struggling to do well in school, and I had to drop out twice. I ended up finishing 4 years after my high school classmates because it was so hard for me to process information.
How did that experience relate to what you're exploring now?
I mean, a couple of things. One is that, I found myself holding myself in very powerless ways. It reminded me of when I was a kid, I would play with these little insects called pill bugs that are like little armadillos.
Yep,
and you pick them up and they roll in a ball. And I always wanted them to trust me, you know, and I thought, oh, I'd pick it up and it wouldn't roll into a ball, but it always did. And I realized, I remember as a kid, that it's because this little bug is afraid of me. I'm giant and scary. When I got into a car as a passenger, I would immediately roll up like a pill bug. And I kind of wonder now, what if I had forced myself open? But the other thing was that I just felt like an imposter. I felt like I did not belong in school. I felt that I would be found out. I honestly, and I'm kind of ironically ashamed to say this, but I felt shame about my head injury. I didn't want people to know. I certainly didn't want people to know about my IQ, although it did come back up quite a bit. And I just struggled with this feeling of I'm going to be found out all the time. And, you know, it's funny that led me to this interest in how can I not have that fear? How can I just be here with what I have and do the best I can do?
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with social psychologist Amy Cuddy about her power pose notions of summoning inner strength, your full self, the power of presence, she calls it. Her new book is Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges. She's with me in the studio, and you can join us. When do you feel most present? What gets you there? And if we were all more present, would the world be a better place? Or too many Wonder Women and men running around. Listeners writing in here, Amy, Sonia writes to us, I was incredibly nervous before my thesis defense this past August, so I made sure to arrive early to campus. She must have been listening to you. Power posing in a deserted bathroom for a couple of minutes had a tangible effect, boosting my confidence. I felt much more assured during my defense, passed with flying colors. Okay, maybe there's an example right there. John writes to us, interesting on this gender front. As a young male, he writes on the website, I was more cognizant of posturing too much power. It's a fine line between showing proper confidence and unnecessarily provoking someone.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I was talking about earlier, that when we show too much dominant body language, it ends up intimidating or provoking, right? So that the response that you're going to get is either someone becoming very submissive or feeling agitated and trying to out-alpha you. So I do think we need to be really mindful of how we carry ourselves when we're in interactions. And what I recommend there is that we carry ourselves with openness, you know, with our shoulders back and our, you know, feet flat on the ground and feeling solid, but also open and showing that we're interested. You know, even so, if you're presenting, you speak, you know, with your arms out and your palms up, which shows a kind of openness and trust, leaning forward to show people that you're interested in what they have to say. But no, there's no need to, you know, in an interaction, go in and stand like a starfish or with your hands on your hips. Certainly, if you do that in a job interview, you'll be escorted out of the building and you won't get the job. It's really about what you do before, in advance. So you prepare with the big poses, you interact with strong but open posture that's warm. And throughout the day, you know, back to the issue of smartphones, you mind your posture. You know, set a reminder on your phone every hour, check your posture. Exactly. Because it's not just power posing. It's simpler things like just having people hold their shoulders back while they give a speech leads them to give a different, more confident kind of speech, or makes them feel happier or remember more positive things from their past. So it doesn't have to be the big poses. It can just be sitting up straight.
Amy Cuddy is right here with us and sitting up straight in the studio. Kate in Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ms. Cuddy. I have so much I relate to and could comment on, but I did want to share a positive anecdote based on your 2012 TED Talk that I show to. I teach oral communication at a couple of colleges here in Rhode Island, and the basketball team, I had three members of the basketball team in my class, and they went on. Some of them are really great athletes, and one of them, a 6'9 guy, had to go to the Big East Media Conference at Madison Square Garden, where, you know, many microphones thrust in his face and press from all over and media plying him with questions and how do you feel about this and that. And he said he just about panicked. He said it was really, really difficult for him. And he got a break, and he said, I went into the bathroom, like the writer before, the email person, and did the power pose. And you can just picture this 6'9 guy doing the power pose. And he said he did it for 2 minutes. He came back in, and he said he felt just much more grounded, much more able to handle the situation and express himself. And so that's a success story. And also, just real quickly, the male, the gender thing, when people give speeches, oftentimes I ask the women to try standing with both their feet kind of planted on their ground, because oftentimes they sort of cock a hip to one side or cross their legs even as they're standing.
Yep.
And for the men to even experiment with sort of softening their stance. And it's just, there's so, there's so much to it, and I really appreciate your work. So,
thank you, Kate. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in.
A 6'9" guy, basketball star, still needs this. Still can use this.
I love that. And so, I mean, right, everyone feels this way sometimes. You know, it's such a universal experience, and that's one of the things that I think really came out in the emails that I got. And I want to share one really recent story. I went to a beauty salon to get a treatment before I was doing something on TV.
Yep.
So I explained to the woman I'm doing this TV thing, and she said, "Oh, okay." She goes, "I have some other advice, and it's not beauty related." But she said, "You know, if you're a little nervous," she said, "I want you to do this." And she stood with her arms out and sort of up like a gorilla. And she said, "I call this the gorilla." She goes, "Now,
do you wear a sign that's saying I'm Amy Cuddy who gave the?"
So this is what was so great about it. She goes, "Now, it might seem strange, and I don't know if you watch TED Talks, but I learned it on there." And I said, "Yeah, I'm her." And she goes, "I know. Aren't we all?" Which I thought was great, because what she was saying is, don't we all feel scared?
Yeah.
Right? Don't we all feel this way? Right. And I said, "Yes,
no,
we
I'm
are."
Really her.
I said, "Yes, we are, but actually I'm her also."
So. Oh, it's all right there. Meg in Guilford, Connecticut. Meg, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing this show.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I am a university professor, PhD from some high-powered school, and I still feel like an imposter all the time, maybe even more so because of the field I'm in. And I have been using these power poses ever since I heard about them from my sister-in-law who works in business. I mean, I did, you know, superwoman pose in the elevator on my way to job interviews, and I really do agree with previous callers about the gender differential.
In what way, Meg?
Well, that I think that women, and especially young women professionals, have a tendency to err on the side of trying to be nice, friendly, make concessions. And I think it's really important for us to learn how to take up our space without veering too far into trying to turn into, you know, alpha males, to steal a phrase. So it's something I work on all the time, trying to learn how to take up my own space. And to be both present, but not just present, but present in a powerful way, too. Powerful, but not aggressive or off-putting. And I wonder, actually, if, Amy Cuddy, you could speak on how, you know, the gender differential in, you know, maybe men coming across as aggressive or alpha male, but women coming across as, I don't know, bossy, or just, I don't know what word you'd pick.
Yeah.
But how do we find this balance?
Yep. So, you know, my previous research was all about how we perceive other people on these dimensions of competence and warmth, and how that affects impressions of women versus men. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about this as well. And I think that one thing that I find people get confused about is that warmth isn't about being too agreeable. And I do think women do tend to learn that they're supposed to make a lot of concessions and smile and nod a lot. Warmth really is about being trustworthy and trusting, and that takes a kind of self-trust and strength to be able to do that, because sometimes you're walking into a really challenging situation, and to be able to show that you're trusting and trustworthy, that's cueing that you're warm, right? That's cueing that you you're human and can connect with people. So I think that it's really about finding that balance, not trying to be too tough. I think that they are not mutually exclusive. You can be both trustworthy and also strong, but you have to not think of trustworthy as making too many concessions and being overly agreeable and smiley.
We're sitting here in the middle of a presidential primary season. We've got lots of people who are very exposed right now on the campaign trail. Think with us about that for just a second. Take two. Gender's come up, but also this whole idea of how much is enough, how much is too much. Hillary Clinton, how's she doing on the physical presentation side and navigating these tricky waters of gender? Because you can elicit pushback from people given the cultural legacy that we're living in. On the other hand, what about Donald Trump? Is he, like, been power posing maybe more than necessary? You know, you can come out all full of yourself. And some people are going to respond very well to that, and others may say, "Wait a minute, that's a lot of self, and not more than that."
So, Let me just, little disclaimer, not making any endorsements here. Also, the last time I talked about specific candidates' body language, I got more hate mail than I could ever imagine. So it doesn't seem to matter who I'm talking about. This is what happens. But let me just say some general things mm-hmm. to look for. What people respond to, and this is something I talk about in the beginning of the book, is they want to see that you believe the story you're telling. So if you're making promises, you better look like you believe them. And the only way you can look like you believe them is if you do believe them, because we cannot fake authenticity. So what you're looking for is body language that's consistent with the words. You want to see people who don't look overly scripted, right? So who's body language is mirroring, you know, it's moving in concert with the words that they're saying. So you shouldn't be telling a happy story and looking scared, or, you know, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be telling a sad story and looking happy, or just overly choreographed. What you want to see is that they really believe what they're telling you, because that is actually a really good signal of whether or not they're going to follow through with what they're trying to promise. And as we know in politics, no one can really promise anything. But that's what I would say you should look for. I do find political debates to be a guilty pleasure, you know, watching the body language and trying to figure out who's believing the message they're telling and who's not believing it.
Take us a little deeper then into the idea of presence. I mean, we've taken a few passes at it, but it's kind of endless the way you define it in its potential depth. This is about really being in touch with oneself and presenting. It sounds so simple, presenting that to the world rather than what you think somebody wants at that moment, or what you're too scared to say or show what you really feel. What ultimately, with throwing your arms wide and expensive, what ultimately is this thing that Walt Whitman's writing about, that you're pointing us toward, that you want the connection you want to see made here?
Well, I think one thing I wanted to do with this book was take presence off of its pedestal and make it accessible to people. So it's not something that you strive for your whole life and finally reach some permanent state, mm-hmm. you know, the day before you die. There's no monk in the world who's present all the time. So the first is to think of presence as something
monks,
that happens
in moments.
So you're
going to a Buddhist conception right there. Be here now. Be fully in the moment.
Right.
That's part of it.
But I think what happens is that people think that means be here now all the time, and no one can do that. And so then they're daunted by it, they're intimidated, and they back off. I want people to think of it as something that you can achieve in moments. It's going to come and go, and that's okay. So it's really about being able to understand and access the best parts of yourself under stressful situations. So your knowledge, your skills, your core values, your personality, to bring that forth when you need to. I think that
not all the time? I mean, why can't we live in that? Wouldn't that be the goal?
It would be. It definitely would. I mean, one is just that we don't have the cognitive bandwidth to be that focused all the time. But another is that, you know, and I think that the biggest obstacle to presence is social anxiety about being mm-hmm. judged by others, and, you know, our
sure.
fear of not fitting in.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening is that we're most likely to feel these things when we're powerless, and we end up getting in the way of ourselves. So I think that sometimes in order to be present, we have to get out of the way of ourselves so we can be ourselves. Because when we're stuck in our heads ruminating over what we think people think of us, there's no way we can hear what's actually happening and engage. Sometimes we have to let go of those fears. We can't control what everybody thinks of us. We can only control what we're presenting. So that social anxiety, which is something everyone has experienced, is, I would say, the biggest obstacle to presence.
But that deeper candor or presence that you can communicate when you're past that, how much more satisfying it is to interact with that, let alone be exuding it. Victoria in Dayton, Ohio, you're on the air with Amy Cuddy. Thanks for calling, Victoria.
Hi. I was wondering if she could address how a amputee could present themselves in public in a wheelchair. I lost my leg 2 years ago. I do have a prosthetic,
yep.
but I ended up having reconstructive surgery
okay.
and back in the wheelchair.
Yep.
And I know when I'm on two legs, I get a certain reaction. When I'm in the chair, I get nothing but the negative reaction. Although my eyes are bright, I
yeah.
make contact with my face.
Yeah.
I speak clearly. but I still get that negative reaction because I'm seated in a wheelchair.
Victoria, we hear all that brightness, but we can also, I'm sure, Amy, you understand that the challenge Victoria is wrestling with there. What have you got for her?
Yeah, thanks for calling, Victoria. That's a real challenge, and I've talked to quite a few people with physical disabilities that prevent them from being able to expand in that way. And, you know, I want to just sort of validate your experiences by saying that is happening. There are biases that are going to prevent some people from perceiving the full you. So I don't want to say this is something that will get you over it completely. But one of the women, one of the people who contacted me, who I keep in touch with, is a woman named Christine who has no mobility below her neck. But she says she imagines herself in these powerful postures, sort of in a thought bubble. And so she teaches public speaking to people with physical disabilities and how to present their fullest self, even if they're in a wheelchair. So we thought, well, that's really interesting. I wonder if there's anything to that. So we started doing studies, having people imagine themselves in powerful or powerless postures. And we couldn't believe how huge the effects were on the thoughts people were having during that experience. So the people who were imagining themselves in these big, powerful postures described themselves as confident, grounded, solid, strong, happy, optimistic. The people who imagined themselves in powerless poses felt threatened, scared, judged. They felt that they were being tormented. It was really an extreme difference in the feelings that were generated. And, you know, this is just one way of approaching it. There's also, you're probably aware of the research showing that, you know, when we imagine moving, it actually stimulates areas of the motor cortex of the brain. So there certainly is a link between what we're imagining in terms of posture and movement and what's happening in the brain.
We self-induce presence, you write, and you're saying even if you don't have the full body, Victoria, that you might wish to actually act it out, even just imagining that pose.
It's a piece of the puzzle, and I don't want to say it's all of it, of course.
Victoria, we wish you luck with that, and I appreciate your call. Everybody's got their challenges. Yours physical right there, but we can hear that brightness, and there's something to take forward right in the mind that I hope will work for you. Amy Cuddy, it's amazing how much people care about this realm, how richly they've responded to your original speech, and even today, just all the calls and comments coming in here, people want to find this connection that you're writing about in presence. Thanks for your work, and thanks for sharing it with us today. It's really been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Cuddy, she is author of Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.